It's Wednesday. It's 1 o'clock. It's time for the Indie Media Radio London show, brought to you on Resonance FM 104.4, bringing protest stories direct from the streets, posted onto the indiemedia.org.uk newswire and to global indie media sites worldwide. We look forward to presenting your stories, so keep posting them to indiemedia.org.uk. It's a bright December morning, and today on the Indie Media Newswire show, we're going to be playing the documentary for the Remember Sara Wewa, the Living Memorial. It's actually a DVD that was made by two London filmmakers who are called Judy Price and Andrew Canono, and the documentary explores the five shortlisted artist proposals for a memorial to the Nigerian poet Ken Sara Wewa, who was executed 10 years ago on the 30th of November. The project really explores the artist proposals for the Living Memorial to Ken, and they have now finally been decided. The two artists that have been picked have been Siraj Ishar and Sakari Douglas Camp. But have a listen. Hope you enjoy.
Despair. He cursed the earth for spouting oil, black gold they called it, and he cursed the gods for not drying the oil wells. This poor woman wept those tears of despair. What could he look into later? Could he make alternate land available? And would the lawmakers revise the laws just to bring a bit more happiness to these unhappy wretches whom the search for oil had reduced to an animal existence? They ought to send the oil royalties to the men whose farms and land were despoiled and ruined, but the lawyers were in the pay of the oil companies, and the government people in the pay of the lawyers and the companies. So how could he look into it later? He should have told the woman to despair, to die, not to live in death.
To lose one's memory is to lose all coordinates. It is to fail to navigate one's past and present. The executors of Ken Sara Wewa would like to maintain the impossibility of memory. This act is grafted on all of us, and we ask, what type of violence is needed to destroy memory? What kind of unmercifulness will not afford the dignity of remembering? Is it possible to reclaim memory and to refuse to accept amnesia? Milan Kundera says that the struggle of humanity against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. We cannot forget, because their act is like an echo replayed by every voice ever speaks, every song sung, every product brought. It comes back over and over again and asks, what forces are these patterns? What hungers belong to you? Forgetting is an act of shame, and we're all driven mad by these symbols and our ease of forgetting.
Opposed certain elements of the system. It's a project about his life, what he did in his life, what he campaigned for, what he campaigned against, which of course will involve a critique of multinationals, the role of Shell, the role of corrupt government. He was arguing for a sustainable energy policy in the world. He didn't say stop drilling for oil, he said drill responsibly. He said, give the people of the Niger Delta what is their due. When people deliberately set out to execute a writer, a man of passion and his eight friends, I'm outraged. And I think as human beings, we should be outraged. To actually destroy people's lives for profit is wrong. And I am angry. But anger alone isn't enough.
We're using the beauty of the Niger Delta in a very specific way.
You get the bright, lit-up background counterposed to the front with the beauty of the plants that we're growing and the trees.
We'd like to make it as interactive as possible, and with the kiosk at the back, we can show slides and films and it can be opened up. So it's the start of something that lots of other people could contribute to. Hopefully you could get schools involved in planting up the plants.
We envisage Friends of the Earth getting involved for a month.
To get local graffiti artists involved with decorating the forecourts. And I think it'll work on the level of, you know, just as a drive-by, as you're sort of driving home or whatever, there'll be a message.
To make sure that their deaths weren't for nothing, you have to keep their ideas alive. The Niger Delta doesn't have to be destroyed like this. There is a huge wave of resistance beginning to stand up. These massive events that have taken place in Brazil, in the Indian subcontinent, that are saying, no, this is wrong. You can still be angry at what they did to Ken, but that isn't really what his death's about. It's about taking his ideas forward, about creating a better world. And we want to raise the question through Ken's memorial of a sustainable world.
An image promises a journey into new possibilities and dimensions of self. Why then do these images seem so strange? Why does one feel so cheated? Is it because something is being denied? We wonder why images appear so alienating. Is it because we are eclipsed when we ask, what is the real function of these things? Whose interest do they serve? Behind all of this rests a lie. What we see will never be enough because they are talking about the wrong thing. They want to blot out our deepest wish to recall. These monuments of despair have come to determine our limits and to make us fear our desires. They speak to me of things like failure and death. They are the means through which we learn our catastrophic loss. We lose our place, we lose our eyes, we lose our minds. Certain events become unbearable, unrecoverable, and we would like to bury them. But then we lose our place for dreams.
from Ekiti in Nigeria, which is the Yoruba part of Nigeria. My idea for this project is called Petals of Life. Tenseru Wiwa, he brought out light out of his people, and that light reflected to the Western world. The light for them to fight for truth and justice, for other people to see what oil companies are doing to the people in Nigeria. Petals of Light have a lot of components. One of those components is water. The central water is a bubbling water. The other water, which is the outer channel of the design, is a moving water. And then apart from that, there's white light projecting from the water upward, meeting other color light, which is reflecting from the 8 Ogoni hands. I have a moving hand holding a pen. That pen is a pen of hope. It's a pen of message, not only for this generation, but for the future generation. And the pen is holding a leaf. And that leaf is talking about the Ogoni environment, where the land, the farms, all polluted. All the greenery is all dead. Then on the floor also, there are photographs of the struggle. There's Kenseruwa's photographs. There's the 8 Ogoni leaders who are executed with Kenseruwa. There's the polluted environment, the broken down of houses, the faces of the people. There are protests also. There'll be plastic slates which invite people to participate. And this slate is for people to write their thoughts. It can be a poem, protest, or even a drawing. So what I've created a living gallery for Kenseruwa. My temporary site for this installation is the Brunel Gallery near the SOAS, School of African Oriental Studies. My second site is at the British Library. It's a center of great writers like Shakespeare and many great thinkers. I regarded Kenseruwa as too a great African thinker.
We must blot out everything that we know about the history of an era. This is the history of the victors. These monuments to violence have an unexpressed underside. They create a sense of time, and they wipe out the possibility of diversity. They are the monuments of violence, callousness, stupidity, obscenity. This memory despairs of grasping and holding the genuine historical image, the endless struggle for liberty, dignity, and freedom. To keep these monuments in place, the global elite agrees to the overthrow of elected governments, the corruption of whole economies, and the invasion of countries. All these acts are deep psychic reminders of what happens when the law of humanity is transgressed. This history fills our silences.
This project is important to me because it is about my part of the world, and yet it has everything to do with the rest of the world, and I didn't realise how much till I got really involved in the project. I come from a small town in the Niger Delta, and we've always had oil flares around us. The oil flares are ghastly and have more pollution in them than you'd find in a booming city like New York, and we only have about 2 cars in my town. The other reason that it's important, of course, is because it's a memorial for Kenseru Wiwa, a remarkable man. The things that he said just showed you that he was just so clued about what oil meant in Nigeria and what oil means to the world. Ken's memory is a shame on Nigeria, it's a shame on the world. And I wanted something positive to aim for and some kind of accountability for what's going on in the Delta. I wanted to show Nigerian character and spirit because, of course, I believe in my country and I'd like my adopted country to know that they play a part in what's happening in Nigeria. I chose a bus. I wanted my bus to have information coming out of it. Like a battle bus, I wanted it to speak. The words around the bus actually say, I accuse the oil companies of practicing genocide against the Ogoni. My structure also has oil barrels on the top of the bus, just because Ken died with 8 other men, and I've got their names cut into these oil barrels. I tried to make a frame on the bus that echoed some of the charred forests that you have in the Delta areas nowadays because of oil fires. You have these, so it's like sort of a graveyard of trees. I hope that my memorial piece will be put anywhere where you might find an ice cream bus or a library bus. This project has a lot to do with world trade, the trade in oil, and the fact that I've chosen a vehicle, it plays a great part because we get a lot of recycled vehicles in the Delta. But it's this recycling that is also important, that people are aware of what happens to these vehicles and things that are resold to different places where, yes, they get a mark of Nigeria, but they actually came from the West. There's areas of the world that are used as holiday areas, and there's areas of the world that are used as dustbins, industrial dustbins, and Nigeria is one of those. The Delta region, which I think is one of the most beautiful places in the world, it's one of the wonders of the world, is just being trashed.
We are shattered by our encounters with genocide, slavery, exile, colonialization, globalization, war. This shattering tears us apart from humanity, separates man from woman, body from mind, world from souls. It tears us apart from ourselves. But deep in our heart, we know that these unspeakable and irreparable conflicts provide our fundamental connection to humanity.
The reason I was thinking of printing presses was partly because of Sarawiwa as a writer using his literature, poems, plays as part of his political campaigning. The other reason was that the press is the place where the words and thoughts are disseminated, and it's like the press is the point of danger. It's what's seized in revolutions, it's what needs to be controlled. And I think what we needed to do was take the British consciousness of politicking and campaigning and use that in this memorial. The printing presses sat on top of 9 cenotaphs, which are empty tombs. And I thought, if we're remembering Ken Sarawiwa in London, then in a way we had to offer hospitality to his spirit. The other connection that I made between West Africa and London was the traditions of memorial. And I was thinking of our material or cultural image of the Delta Lands of Nigeria being the famous Benin bronzes. And in England, one has a tradition of memorial brasses. They were living memorials in their own right to prompt intercession on the behalf of the souls of the dead. In this contemporary situation, what I wanted to do was prompt intercession on behalf of the living people of Ogoni Land. My thought was that by making an interactive memorial, one would be prompting political action, a little thought in somebody's head, one would be prompting a shift in consciousness. So I took Tavistock Square because in London it's a little very tranquil garden that encapsulates the non-violent direct action traditions. There's 9 lime trees, very beautifully separated. And to me it seemed a perfect place to place underneath the 9 cenotaphs. The site that I chose for the permanent memorial was to have the 9 brass slabs facing the shell building on the South Bank.
You can walk through London and be totally isolated from the consequences. The natural resources and labour which were extracted to pay for this. The energy that is taken out of every part of the world to build these spectacles. The real price in human rights, lost celebrations, lost families. The incalculable violations committed to build these familiar pleasures. To recover from this, we make ourselves into objects, and we have not yet realized that the loss of liberty, the collapse of justice, the banishment of ideals, are not minor grievances, but are felt as deeply as the loss of a loved one, a sibling, or a country. This system of perpetual production and consumption grasps nearly the whole of our lives. There is truly a war going on against all of us and our attempts at coherent, rational thoughts. This war now takes place in every part of our lives, every activity, our work, our dreams, our conflicts, our relations to others. In fact, our relationship to life and the planet itself is now stripped of all sensible meanings. They are concealed to give way to the inexhaustible and spectacular gluttony of the feast.
I sort of gave myself a discipline with this project. Okay, the idea was a 1 kilowatt project. Okay, what can you do with 1 kilowatt? Which is how much energy you use to boil a kettle of water. And how can that be visible when you take on big corporations? How do I change that? I've got the 3 spheres because triangulation is what nature is about. It's how you achieve stability and symmetry. And one deals with the local environment as Mother Earth, as a surrogate natural environment. Every day we could collect data from the weather office and say if the carbon dioxide, the sulfur dioxide levels, as they change, the colours change. And this globe, as a symbol, has on the outside the Niger Delta, or the tributaries. So that those can change in colour depending on how the environment in London is being polluted. And the other deals with our cultural environment, which is what we produce, all our mobile phones, our internet, our radio waves. So people can send SMS texts to it, people can email to it. The other one is our physical energy, how much energy we are we're generating from the bicycles, or we're taking from the host building or site that the work is based in. Essentially, we're living in two environments. There's an actual physical environment, and there's a huge virtual environment. And the server, the website, is an important part of this project, because the spheres, all the material things, the actual context, whether it's a Gherkin building, whether it's a housing estate in the East End, there's also a parallel universe, which is the website, the virtual space. All the SMS texts are going there from all over London, all over the world, in the bits of poetry that are being coming out from people's everyday lives, from the inner depths. And that is how people interact with the work. On this plinth, you know, there are scrolling messages in white. It's changing the colour of the balloons. It's coordinating, you know, from the street. And I think it's time to kind of disperse the most beautiful things that we do in as many ways as possible to magnify this process. You know, it is part of a communication ecosystem. And to try and use these things which are for urban chatter for more beautiful things. The terrible thing that we have done is we have completely restructured the order of things, and as a result we have grossly savaged the relationship chain between ourselves and the planet. We're living in an age where we can sit in our living rooms and watch someone literally starve, okay, and that's doing something to us. It's just doing something to our psyche without us knowing it. The problem is that we are so stuck within the structures that have been set up for us that sooner or later we get assimilated, habituated into them. Our level of empathy becomes diluted to the point that it just becomes, it's transient. We think about it at breakfast time, and by the time it's lunchtime, you know, it's off our memory.
By changing your focus, you hear another world calling you. How can you look at loss when loss attacks your ability to see? We need to accept loss in order to restore sight. This loss must be marked, but it cannot be represented. Mourning works by bringing into view images or spaces that linger somewhere. By losing our ability to mourn and grieve, we are cast adrift from the web of human consciousness. Without mourning, you cannot recognize the other. You cannot see your responsibility for the other. These are the prerequisites of dialogue. By changing your focus, you hear another world calling you. And this is the beginning of political activism and critique.
The Living Memorial to Ken Sarawiwa is a landmark public art project for London, landmark in that it addresses the underrepresentation of people of colour in the London cityscape, landmark in that it puts the issue of environmental justice directly in the public gaze, landmark in that it activates the debate about London's ethical relationship to the wider world, landmark in that it raises the stakes on innovations in public art. The winning commission was announced on the 10th anniversary of Ken's execution on November the 10th, 2005, and it will be placed in 5 temporary sites across London before it's installed in its permanent home in 2008. The whole project will be animated by a programme of education and publications. The catalogue and accompanying DVD, which was just played out by video artists Judy Price and Andrew Canono, explores the 5 shortlisted artist proposals And the artists that were featured were Sakari Douglas Camp, Siraj Ishar, Emmanuel Jagadi, Emily Johns, Francis Newman, Jeff Jackson, Not Architects, with texts by Ken Wewer and Platform. And for more information on the Ken Sara Wewer Memorial, you can check out the Remember Ken Sara Wewer Memorial website, and you can check out Platform on www.platformlondon.org and remembersarawewer.org. And now we're going to play some music by a musician that's been working in Cuba, and she's just put an album together called Donde Esta Mi Carazoni, and we're going to play Mama Lele by Lindsay Schurst.
Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Your radical radio.
And The music you were just listening to was by Lindsay Schurst, and if you liked that, you can check out her website, which is www.mamalaylee.com. That's www.mamalaylee.com. Just when you thought it could get no worse, neo-Labour goes nuclear. You may have heard about the Greenpeace activists who delayed Blair's announcement of the energy review, but he whispered campaign about the push for nuclear power has been gaining momentum since last year. Until then, Britain's nuclear programme seemed to be largely written off as the costly and dangerous failure it was. Nobody even knows how to safely decommission the power stations already built or store the radioactive waste that's already produced. Britain's nuclear power programme was historically dogged with safety issues, radioactive contamination, and of course, massive overspend. And yet now we're supposed to sit back and swallow the construction of a few more of these toxic dumps? How are they going to sell this to us, the British public? You have to stand back and admire the propaganda. In the face of a potentially very cold winter, neo-Labour is using their own incompetence in not securing sufficient energy supplies or efficiency to go round, saying, do you want Granny to shiver alone at Christmas? Do you want to have to rely on gas pumped thousands of miles across steppes, haunted only by bearded jihadists every time you want a cup of tea? So come on, what's a little radioactive waste between friends? This glowing bombshell is being slipped in under the umbrella of a wide-ranging review of all Britain's energy needs. But Tony's think tanks have come to the conclusion that wind turbines in marginal countryside constituencies are big vote losers, and it's the intoxicating power of glowing uranium rather than hippie wind and wave power that the Confederation of British Industry wants. So it's likely that's what they'll get. Even Johnny Ball, CBBC's Mr. Science, was seen way in on the side of radioactive waste dumps on Channel 4 News. So far, the need for nuclear power is being pushed on energy shortages, national security issues, and the need to cut carbon emissions. The first two have an element of truth, but only if we want to carry on in the same energy wasteful consumerist way as before. If that's the case, then we need more energy. The problems currently being encountered in Iraq have signalled that we may not be able to just help ourselves to the world's hydrocarbon reserves without a backlash. Or, in other words, if we want the shopping malls, then we've got to put up with a perpetual state of war. Seizing the initiative, the nuclear lobby came crawling back into the debate, claiming to have the solution to energy shortage and Britain's security. They reckon their magic solution, hedging Britain's energy bets by including nuclear in the power remix, will cut UK carbon emissions. These claims fail to impress on closer inspection, leaving us wondering why precisely the government is floating this idea now. Is it anything to do with the UK PLC's need to hang on to an independent nuclear deterrent and a source of weapons-grade plutonium? British Nuclear Fuels, which will be administering the PFI contracts for reactors, is also the major shareholder in Britain's militarised reactor at Aldermaston. Britain's 12 nuclear power stations provide a quarter of our electricity now, but unless they are replaced with new ones as they reach retirement, then there will only be 3 nuclear stations left in operation by 2020, producing less than 10% of our current consumption. The plan was to reduce nuclear power with wind and solar energy so that by 2020, green energy would account for a fifth of our total electricity consumption. The National Audit Office reported back in February that electricity bills would need to rise by over 10% if we are to meet these targets. With an inability to meet even modest targets over the next 15 years, there is no hope of achieving Britain's longer-term goal of cutting carbon emissions by 60% while sustaining continual growth, unless nuclear is somewhere in the energy mix. Therefore, and unbelievably, the biggest nuke programme since the 1960s is being sold as the cornerstone of our environmental protection policy. Of course, the idea that we cut down on our levels of carbon emissions by cutting down on consumption of fuels and products is politically unthinkable. So put memories of the Three Mile Island and Chernobyl disasters to one side. Forget about British nuclear fuel's poor health and safety record for just one moment. Try not to recall the evidence of increased cancer risk for people living near power stations. Try not to think about how safe having a new load of nuclear reactors is likely to make us. Forget the scattered depleted uranium. This is a carbon neutral way of meeting our emission targets. Is it not? Well, no. Not when you take into account the preparation of uranium for the reactor, which involves mining and milling the ore, fuel enrichment and fuel rod fabrication. Then there's the construction of the power station itself. At the other end, there's a reactor decommissioning and treatment, storage, transport and disposal of nuclear waste. All in all, Greenpeace reckon that CO2 emissions from nuclear power are at least a third of those from traditional fossil fuels. Not only that, this all but ignores the relatively small role played by nuclear power in the overall energy economy. The UK fleet of 23 operating nuclear reactors generates just 22% of the UK's electricity. Electricity generation currently accounts for 37% of UK's carbon dioxide emissions, with transport and heating the other major sources. So all in all, even if all 23 nuclear reactors were closed and electricity generation was replaced by a mix of coal, gas and renewables, UK carbon dioxide emissions would only rise about 10%. In contrast, clean, renewable power sources, hand in hand with reduced consumption and energy efficiency measures, offer the best hope for preventing global climate catastrophe.
If the life you have created has buried you in luxuries outdated, and you ask, what is the purpose? Too weak to claw your way up to the surface. You resent all of your trophies. They belittle human spirit like a timepiece that is ticking in your breast pocket. And so you long to reach in and stop it. And then your heart, it will be broken. And every sour word that you have spoken about everybody else will return to act upon yourself. If the life you have created is founded on jealousy and hatred, it's too late to ask questions. For you're much too old to take any suggestions. It's the life you have created. It's the life you have created. It's the life. It is the life. It is the life. The life you have created, it is the life you have created, it is the life, it is the life, it is the life, it is the life, it is the life.
And that was It's the Life by Grant Lee Buffalo. Well, it just about remains to say goodbye. We're now going to play out with an interview with the people about the kidnappings recently of the Christian peacemaker teams in Iraq. The interview is with an ISM member, and we hope you enjoy. Bye-bye.
Four peace activists working with the group were kidnapped in Baghdad and are being held hostage by a group calling itself the Swords of Righteousness Brigade. The situation has sparked outrage across the Middle East. Three of the four CPT prisoners currently being held had previously done relief work in Palestine. This week, 300 Palestinians in Ramallah held a demonstration calling for the release of the four peace activists kidnapped in Iraq. With more on that, we'll hear from Hawaida Araf, a spokesperson for the International Solidarity Movement. Can you just talk briefly to the work of the ISM?
Well, the International Solidarity Movement was founded in conjunction or shortly after the outbreak of the Second Intifada, more accurately in the spring of 2001. And it was founded to be a resource for the Palestinian nonviolent resistance, because the Palestinian civilians that were resisting the occupation by demonstrating or protesting alone were being faced by a massive military force. The Israeli army was coming at us with their tanks, with their M-16s, with their helicopters. And in the first few months of the Intifada, hundreds of unarmed Palestinian civilians were shot dead. So we had this idea of getting the international community actively involved in the Palestinian resistance so that international civilians from all over the world could see with their own eyes what was happening, could relay this back to their respective media outlets, to their friends and families and colleagues back home, and at the same time, with their time, the time they spend in the occupied Palestinian territories, they can form provide protective accompaniment for Palestinians, because, like I said, Palestinians protesting alone were being shot at. They were being faced and attacked with lethal force. But when you have internationals with Palestinians, the Israeli government, the Israeli military realizes this, and generally they use less lethal forms of violence. So for the protective accompaniment, for the witnessing, and for the informative spreading of information, the International Solidarity Movement, or the active involvement of international civilians, provided this resource for Palestinians to continue using civilian grassroots forms of organizing and resisting a very repressive occupation.
The reason I called you today is actually to talk about the situation in Iraq with four Christian Peacemakers team members who were taken hostage over the last week. And it's come to light that two of those four have actually worked in the occupied territories in the West Bank and Gaza. Can you just talk briefly to their work with the ISM or with the situation there in Palestine?
Sure. Actually, three of them have been in the occupied Palestinian territories. One of them, James, was in Palestine 5 years ago with the Christian Peacemaker Team. And the International Solidarity Movement works very closely with the Christian Peacemaker Team. Actually, they were an active part of our first campaign, and we constantly coordinate to best support a Palestinian nonviolent resistance and to witness and report. So the relationship is very close. But one of the four, Harmeet Sudan, he's a Canadian citizen who's been living in New Zealand. He actually came over to the occupied Palestinian territories with the International Solidarity Movement. During his time with us, he assisted Palestinian farmers in harvesting their olives and in resisting the wall, which Israel's building, which is confiscating much Palestinian farmland and destroying, or has destroyed, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian trees. He was an active part of standing in solidarity with Palestinians in their resistance, in attempting to live their lives, to harvest their olives, which Palestinian farmers often can't do because they're attacked by settlers or they're prevented by the Israeli military. I know that the four were in Iraq for similar means, to resist occupation, to listen to the people that have been living under occupation, and to try to take this information back to their home countries. I know that the time that they spent in Palestine, they were warmly received and loved and respected by the Palestinian communities that they touched and that they came into contact with. And as a result, we've seen since their kidnapping, the Palestinians have come out very strongly in support of their safe release and have issued numerous statements over the past couple of days. From all over, the Palestinian Authority on an official level released a statement calling for their safe release. the Minister of Islamic Affairs in Palestine, Sheikh Ikrama Sabri, or Imam Ikrama Sabri, also released a statement asking for their safe release. Palestinian political parties and even the armed resistance in Hebron, the Christian Peacemaker team is based in Hebron, and they worked most closely with the Palestinians in Hebron. All of the Palestinian political factions in Hebron released a statement calling on the Iraqi resistance to release the Christian Peacemaker team safely. In their statement, they said that these Christian Peacemaker team activists have stood with us, and they face the gas with us, and they face the violence of the Israeli occupation with us, and they stood with us to help, and I know that we know that they were with you to help. They are not spies, and we need to respect and take care of them, and we ask you to safely release them. Yesterday in the center of Ramallah, there was a large demonstration of political activists, members of the armed resistance, members of the religious community, the Union of Palestinian Islamic Scholars, and official members of the Palestinian Authority and members of civil society gathered also to demonstrate for the safe release of the four peace activists. And we're working, we're hoping, and we're praying that if this is a legitimate resistance body, group that is just resisting or trying to resist the occupation of their country that kidnapped the four activists, then they will hear the pleas and they will know that it was wrong to do what they did, and that these four aren't spies. These four were standing in solidarity with the Iraqi people. These four were actively working, not only in Iraq, but in Palestine also, against occupation of any kind. So if it is a legitimate anti-occupation group, we don't know really anything about the group that took them, then hopefully they will hear these messages and release them soon. However, there are some doubts as to the nature of this group that that carried out the kidnapping. Some unexplainable piece of information have come to light. For example, yesterday, the Israeli military arrested a Palestinian journalist that has been documenting all of the Palestinian actions and pleas for the safe release of the Iraqis. They say that they arrested him on security reasons, but they haven't said what those security reasons are. And this cameraman was filming, and he's a cameraman for Al Jazeera, the largest Arab satellite network, and they arrested him. Another journalist we just heard may have also been arrested by the Israeli military, and this journalist also had written about the Palestinian call for the safe release. So it casts some doubt, or it's strange or unexplainable, why the Israeli military would be arresting journalists that are helping to air these pleas from Palestinians to the kidnappers.
That's an interesting development that I hadn't heard anything about. I'm wondering if you can speak to the significance of, you know, why is it significant that, you know, the Palestinians are calling for their release? How will that impact the situation?
Well, again, depending on who the kidnappers are, we're not sure if they will, but depending on the reasons that they kidnapped them, if it was, you know, for any kind of political demands, like an end to the occupation, or for American occupation troops to pull out, then they will know that these four are against the occupation and work in their own way against the occupation. Not that it's legitimate to involve any civilian in any kind of attacks or armed resistance, but sometimes it could be that the people that are resisting the occupation of their country see foreigners and mistake them for spies or for anything else. And so we felt that Palestinians, I mean, as Palestinians living under occupation, we know what it's like. We know that we also know the importance of solidarity work, and we wanted to convey that. We wanted to do two things. One, we wanted to get our message out that we know these four aren't spies or collaborators or meant in any way to hurt the Iraqi people. And we want the kidnappers to know that. And two, we want the kidnappers to realize that solidarity work is so very important, and every person that stands in solidarity with you should be welcomed and respected and encouraged, and you don't want to scare these people away. Average civilians don't necessarily represent the actions, the wrong actions of their government. And Palestine over the last few years has benefited tremendously from the thousands of warm, kind-hearted, caring people that have come to the occupied territories to stand with us. And we want also, again, if this is a legitimate resistance group that took them, we want them to know and realize that.
I know you've got a busy day, so I'll just ask you one or two more.